last week and this week, we are finishing our series on the Eightfold Path, or the body of guidelines for practice toward liberation offered by the Buddha. And this final segment, known as samadhi, or integration of mind, brings or sits upon the foundation of all of the other practices in the Eightfold Path, beginning with our orientation toward the world itself, or toward existence, view, the deep beliefs or stories or orientations we have toward being itself. And coming out of those deep frameworks for how we understand who we are and what we might do in this life, then the active cultivation of the conditions of well-being. The second limb of intention, wise intention, and the limbs of action, speech and ethical action and livelihood, ever-increasing circles of how our life affects not only our own unfolding, but through relationship and community and ecosystem, those that we know, those that we don't know, and ultimately all beings in the ecosystem. Whether you think of that as the planetary ecosystem or beyond that, and it's clear that in the Buddhist system the conception is beyond that, even. That our actions radiate out from us in profound ways in all directions. And the chant that we just did in the five recollections ends with this invocation to our relationship to our own actions that that is a sharp reminder, is meant, I think, to be a sharp reminder of the power of action to shape the future, but also the power of action to shape the future in ways that we don't necessarily want. And it says, I am the owner of my actions. Whatever I do, that's mine. That's the only thing that's yours, right? You're not the owner of your body. If you were, the text says, you'd be able to control it, right? As in, keep it from getting sick or aging or keep it from getting unbeautiful. And I know you're trying. And, you know, a very traditional response would be good luck with that, which is only slightly sarcastic. But we try, and it's actually not wrong to try. It's inbuilt that there's a fear of death inbuilt in us. Life prefers to stay alive. And it's not even personal to you, right? Everything seems to lean toward continuing, but succumb to not continuing. And that's the rub, as Hamlet would say. That our actions are interwoven with the natural play of energy in the ecosystem, which is that energy coalesces in forms based in conditions, and when those conditions shift, that form also shifts. The baby is born, grows, has all sorts of experiences, and dies eventually. The garden is seeded and grows and changes, and that process of change is a constant process of birthing and deathing, birthing and dying. And so the teachings on action and this reminder that we are the owner of our actions weave together to say, you don't own your body, you don't own your experiences, you don't own any of your possessions or your relationships, of course. Again, I know you're trying, and it's natural to do so. But what you own, which is to say, the one thing you have control over, and that's the equation here, ownership means you have you can do something about it, is your actions. You choose as best you can how to act. And then, of course, it gets complicated, because even what we are able to choose is conditioned. Right? You can't just choose something and it automatically happens. Otherwise, we might first choose to be profoundly successful and sexy and get everything we want. And then we might get tired of that and choose to be instantly liberated. And that sounds like a nice life to me, really, you know. A whole bunch of all the stuff I was trying for years, and then a whole bunch of the stuff I was trying for years. And then you're done, right? And in a funny way, the path is structured a bit like that. The earlier limbs are the limbs of action, of relationship and action. What you do with your possessions, your sexuality, your words, the substances you take into your body, your money, how you move through the world making ripples. And those ripples are either going to be helpful or harmful. That's it. And so then the process becomes, in a certain way, this finer and finer grained process of tuning our song, as it were. As in, you're constantly playing a song or singing a song, and this is a metaphor from my life as a classical musician, and especially my life as a violinist, where the primary challenge is not how to be expressive or what to play or to get really good at twiddling your fingers very quickly. The subtle challenge that is always there is to play in tune. That you can kind of bang out stuff, but the difference between something being really affecting and something being harsh is its in-tuneness. And ethical practice is a kind of tuning our actions. Right? We're saying things to people all the time. We can say things in a way that, like, you know, it gets the point across. Fine. Or we can say something in a way that gets the point across and is kind, or uplifts the beautiful qualities in the other person, or makes the whole situation that we're in more sweet, more safe, more delicious. And that's possible. And so the ethical practices say, tune your actions. And this is not me inventing a musician's metaphor, but this is me repeating a musician's metaphor from the early texts. There was a monk who was failing at meditation. Came to his fellow monks and says, "I'm failing. I'm going to drop out of being a monk and go back to being a lay person." And the monks are like, "Wait, let's tell the Buddha first." And the Buddha comes over. The monk's name was Sona. Sona. Bhikkhu Sona. And bhikkhu means monk, essentially, homeless one. The Buddha says, "Bhikkhu Sona, I hear things are going rough for you." And Sona says, "Oh, I can't do it. I can't concentrate. My mind will not take to the training. I'm going to leave the training and go back to lay life because liberation is not for me in this lifetime." And the Buddha kind of sees that what Sona is doing is trying to practice, but not practicing in a way that's in tune. And particularly that his practice is his effort is not focused. And so the Buddha says, "Sona, tell me, before you were a monk, you were a musician, right?" Sona says, "Yes, I was." The Buddha said, "What did you play?" He said, "Oh, I played the veena, which is a stringed instrument." And the Buddha says, "Tell me, Sona, How would you adjust your instrument to bring out the best sound?" And Sona said, "Well, blessed one, you would have to tune the strings so that they are neither too tight nor too loose." And And the Buddha says, as he says, just so, Sona, just so. You should tune your practice or tune your attention, your effort, to be not too tight and not too loose. And we can take that instruction into many aspects of practice. Right? In our sitting meditation, you can try really hard to be concentrated, like, I will not think about anything. And you'll get very tired quickly. I've done it. You can clear your mind doing that. But you can't do it for very long, right? That kind of effort is too tight. It's unsustainable. Not to mention, doesn't in the end really work. You can clear the decks, but it's hard to keep them clear by squeezing. Or you can be the relaxed type, and you can be like, no, I just chill out. I just like, you know, it's cool, man. It's just like, it's kind of just like I just smoked a bowl and I'm just kind of hanging out here. And, you know, you let everything just go. And there's a good quality in that of deep relaxation, right? And of letting go. But it's too loose, right? The mind is going to kind of wander. And there's not enough clarity to restrain it, to restrain the wandering. So the Sona hears the metaphor and says, thank you, Blessed One, goes back to his hut, his patch of leaves, wherever he practices. And the text says, as it says, the formula goes something like, and then in not too long a time, practicing in solitude, ardent, diligent, and resolute, the Bhikkhu Sona achieved that great aim for which a being goes forth from the home life into homelessness. And he knew directly what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And Bhikkhu Sona became another one of the arhants, the liberated beings. That's the tearful conclusion of the story. That's the enlightenment phrase. So it works. Sona tunes his practice to be neither too tight nor too loose and attains the goal of the holy life. Full liberation. And I love the phrase that is intoned in the texts again and again when a being attains full liberation. It says, what had to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. And that is a subtle, difficult thing to explain. There is no longer any coming to any state of being. This is a way of suggesting that grasping and desire are not just things we do that get us caught, that they are actually a way of being, that who I am is a grasping being. That is my identity. That is my existence on this planet, one who grasps. And so what happens when I grasp is I enter a new state of being. I want that person. I want that thing. I want that experience. When that happens, my state of being changes. And it changes out of what might otherwise be a kind of equilibrium in the ecosystem. Right? Rather than just being an animal on the planet going, oh look, now it's raining. Oh look, now it's sunny. I become a being going, darn it, it's raining again. I forgot my galoshes. Where's the umbrella? Why is it raining in June? Climate change. Or a being going, oh my God, it's sunny. I forgot the sunscreen. I'm sure I'm going to get cancer. Climate change. All roads lead to the end of life as we know it. We'll talk about that later. But you know it's happening. Not necessarily the end of life, but the end of life as we know it. And again, it's a state of being. That was a little bit of a digression into climate change, but the point here is that grasping itself changes us, and in a certain way it becomes us, or we become it. We take form when we hook, when the mind gets hooked. So then the phrase for liberation, there is no more coming to any state of being. well, what's happening? What's still happening then? What's left if we no longer grasp and come to states of being? And that's a very subtle existence. So, in the Eightfold Path, coming out of the action limbs, we go into the limbs of inner practice, of effort, mindfulness, and unification, where effort is exactly this practice of not too tight, not too loose, shaping how we guide ourselves moment to moment, bringing in qualities that are skillful or wholesome, decreasing qualities that are unskillful or unwholesome, maintaining our ethical precepts, sharpening the blade of mindfulness. Mindfulness as a limb says that when we are absolutely awake to what's happening, we are also awake to whether it's wholesome or unwholesome, how it fits into what we want to cultivate on the path. And being awake is essentially the opposite of being asleep, but we could say distracted or lost. So then this final limb of samadhi, what is it? The suggestion is something like this. We've been doing all of these things, these actions, this kind of effort to gather ourselves, to resist gently the pull of the unwholesome, and to hone ourselves toward this kind of clarity that doesn't grasp. If we become able to do this moment to moment, like in the micro moment to moment, what starts to happen is that all of the little hooks that the attention encounters that pull us away, they become not hooks. So like, I get a little twinge in my hip, and it's just there. But the hook of, I gotta dig into it and worry about it, maybe fix it, that hook is let go of. I'm not actually worried about it. And I see something I like or somebody I like, but and the beauty of that thing blossoms in my gaze. But the hook is gone. I've seen through the possibility that if I got that thing, I'd be happy. So it's not, doesn't hook me. It's just there. And if we start to do this micro moment to micro moment, the result is that the mind doesn't wander. That the little daydreams of, maybe I could do this and next week would be better. Or, oh dear, I did that. Better worry about it. Or whatever, all the things we do. Or even just the deluded, lost wandering of like, oh, I hear they're making another Spider-Man. Like whatever, wherever your mind goes. If none of those things have a hook, they just stop pulling us. I remember when I'd been kind of resisting mainstream capitalism for just long enough, and I was driving on the 101 into San Francisco one day, and you know that patch where you're driving, you come off the bridge, and you're driving, you're driving in, and it's just big billboards on either side. There's the big Banana Republic one, and there's the big Coca-Cola one, and then there's, over here, there's the one that revolves between tech companies that are all the same, and there's this other one down the way, and at a certain point, I was like, oh, look, they don't work on me anymore, which is to say, I've lost the desire for any of those exact products. I know that I just don't shop at Banana Republic. I just don't need that tech company. I don't ever want to buy a Coca-Cola again. It's over. Guys, I am not your target audience anymore. And realizing that, and you're right, so I'm not fully liberated. If the bubbles were for other things, they could hook me, right? Right? But they weren't. It was those things. And I was like, oh, I'm free of you. Bye-bye. And it was amazing to just be like, oh, there's no hook, so the mind doesn't even follow them. I don't even have to get mad at them. I had 10 years of that, right? drive past the you know, oh, you know, something, whatever. There was this shop in downtown San Francisco, some American type, you know, big clothing retailer. At a certain point, they just put like 3-story high pictures of naked bodies in their window. It's a clothing store, but you know, it was like, hot bodies, you want clothes? And just being like, for a while I was just like, damn you, you know, objectifying capitalist. And it's at a certain point I was like, I see what you're doing, and I don't shop with you. Over. It's over, right? The hook, or the, like, the information is still there, the world is still the way it is, but you don't have to get hooked. And what if that happened about everything? Every little thing that pulls your mind. What's left then, it turns out, is stillness. It's almost like if you just got done with the impulse to do anything, why would you get up? You just hang out in a very natural way. So then samadhi can be thought of as the perfection of letting go. You just kept letting go until the only thing left was chilling out. And you can also think of samadhi as the perfection of mindfulness, because you can't let go to that depth without being aware of every single little hook when it happens. The reason we get hooked, of course, is that we're not aware of it. I go past the billboard of the huge naked bodies, and, you know, on one day I'm like, you know, capitalist hypnotists, but on another day, if I'm a little bit distracted and I don't have my resistance so bright, I drive by them, bike by them really, and some part of my mind goes, ooh, naked bodies. I like those, right? Oh, they're pretty. And that little hook, right? Because, you know, I'm human. I like naked bodies. But the hook comes in, and then I would notice that for like the whole next block, some part of my being is going, naked bodies, naked bodies, naked bodies. Oh my God, naked bodies, pretty naked bodies, skinny naked bodies. And then if I'm mindful, I would be like, oh. Desire has, like lust has arisen based on the visual field. And mindfulness is the necessary piece for unbinding. You can't unhook from something if you don't notice it. And the whole system of delusion functions on you not noticing things, right? Not noticing the presence of lust and therefore acting on it unskillfully. Not noticing the presence of anger or aggression and therefore acting on it unskillfully. If you notice the presence of a quality, then you can act on it skillfully. Right? You can notice the presence of lust, and you can say, I'm noticing the presence of lust in my being, and it happens to be aimed towards someone with whom I have a consensual, intimate relationship. Bravo! You know? wholesome object of lusting. And then you proceed. whatever way you proceed. Or you notice, aha, lust has arisen in relation to an unwholesome object of lusting, which is to say something that's outside the bounds of my vow, of my ethics, whatever that boundary is, no judgment. Then you notice, like, oh, well, that would cause harm to act on that. And again, you notice it, and as soon as you notice it, it unhooks. And one of the magical things about mindfulness is that the noticing and the unhooking are essentially the same thing. As soon as you notice it, you're not as trapped. If mindfulness is bright every single moment, or as it gets trained to be bright more and more moments, you just stay unhooked. If mindfulness flickers in and out, you get unhooked, but then you forget, and then you bike by, and then you're like, ooh, bodies, ooh. You get the end. And you might get lost for a moment. One of the things that points towards samadhi is starting to notice that moment of being lost, even though it's usually colored, often colored by a kind of pleasure, like getting hooked by the naked bodies, is pleasurable. That's why the hook, right? The hook has candy on it. But to start to learn that the flavor of being hooked is actually less pleasurable than the flavor of being unhooked. Once we've learned that, then samadhi is close by. Because it turns out that being unhooked for a sustained period, by which I mean a handful of minutes, that's all really, it starts to feel really good. In the same way that if you've been doing a lot of activity and you lie down in shavasana or a resting pose, right? Initially there's this like, oh. And then maybe you're kind of busy for a while, but if you hang out for 10 minutes, it gets really good to be in the resting pose. So if you can hang out with your mind in the resting pose of samadhi for a handful of minutes, or stretch that out for a little while, it starts to be not only pleasurable, but actually deeply nourishing to the nervous system, to our whole being, to the heart, that in a sense is just exhausted with constant craving. And to stop craving for a little while feels so nice. So nice. Really sweet. So the perfection of mindfulness, the sustaining of continuity of mindfulness, becomes the perfection of letting go. Nothing to hook. When there's no hook, the mind rests naturally in a spacious, quiet, settled place that we call samadhi, the integration of mind. And the flip from that samadhi into nibbana, which is called the unbound, the element of liberation, is they're not the same thing. Samadhi is a state based on conditions. Nibbana is the quality of not being hooked. So, to finish, and I'll talk about nibbana some other time again, but it's something like this. I'm biking through the city, and I'm intent on being unhooked, so I'm focused. And I notice the pull of the different things that are trying to grab me, but I stay with what I'm doing. I don't let myself get hooked. That's samadhi, in an active kind of way. And when I'm sitting, I notice the pull of the possibility of thoughts and other things pulling, and I just stay. And that becomes stable and deep and steady and effortless. That's samadhi. Samadhi becomes nibbana when we... I'll say an aspect of it in a very simple way. When our attention becomes unbound even from the act of being steady or the situation of being steady, when we're not even hooked to steadiness, there's a quality of unhookedness. And that quality itself is nibbana. It's not actually a state. It's not a thing you hang out in. It's an element, really, like the solidity of things that we call the earth element. The quality of unboundness is the quality of nibbana. So nibbana is not a state that we can attain by getting really good samadhi, but samadhi is close to it, because it teaches us how to rest and let everything be just the way it is. As we learn to rest, we learn to tune into this thing that's actually always present. nothing's ever actually hooked to anything else. Hookedness is a psychology based in our being, conscious beings. But in a sense, that's all it is. There's no intrinsic connection between my body and the body of the model who posed for a picture that's now being displayed on the whatever that company was. As soon as I realize that there's no intrinsic hook, it's over. Samadhi is the last limb in the Eightfold Path because there's nowhere to go from there. But we can tune into, or we can create the conditions for the arising into awareness of this quality of unhookedness. Remember that the Eightfold Path is a path. It goes somewhere. And once you're there, you don't need to be on the path anymore. The path exists in order to end itself. And the end is this unhooking. So, may all beings know the liberation of unbinding. So just a few minutes for responses, feelings. Gert.
Sort of a question when you say then you're no longer on the path.
Yeah.
Not that I expect to be here, but
you never know.
Would you then, I mean, that sounds funny to me. It seems like you're always on some kind of path.
Yep.
Unless you're dead, and then who knows where you are.
Yeah. Folks would say to the Buddha, okay, so you're liberated, like, where are you now? Like, you're here with us, right? But what are you doing? And he would say, it's not the right question. It's really difficult to imagine being a way that we've never experienced being. And it's a little bit like someone who's been profoundly traumatized, who's grown up in conditions of deep harm and abuse and systemic limitation of whatever kind, meets someone who grew up in different, who has different conditions, or who has, in whatever way, this is not the best example, because it's charged with politics, but some way of like meets someone from a very different part of the world, say, who just lives a different way, doesn't have the same anxieties, who doesn't struggle with the same things. Can they really understand what that person's life is like? Like, it's kind of impossible. So to say it's possible to not be on a path is a strange thing. You know, it's a little bit like, and this would be a classic Buddhist metaphor, a gazillion lifetimes ago you set out to walk from San Francisco to New York. And it's hard to say exactly where you are right now, but we're all somewhere. in the Nevada desert or, you know, the Nebraska prairie. New York is out there. And we don't know what it's going to be like to get there because we've been walking for so long. All we know is walking. We've never had a home, as long as we can remember, a gazillion generations. But then every once in a while someone shows up and is like, hey, arriving in New York, it's great. You don't have to walk anymore. And some people are like, I don't even know what you're talking about, man. Right? Walking is life. And the person's like, yeah, but you know, when you get done with walking, you can just lie down. And we're like, I don't believe it. Right? Because we have no context for knowing it. So the Buddha proposes that there is an end of the path where the path is simply, how do I not get stuck, hooked by things? And the Buddha's like, yeah, just get totally unhooked. And I'm like, yeah, there's always going to be hooks. Right? And then along comes swimming a fish that, with the marks of torn out hooks in her gills. And she's like, don't get hooked. And I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about. I've got hooks and lines and everything. And I'm pulling against them. And she's like, yeah, heal those and don't bite any new ones. Right? And until I know what that feels like, I don't know what that feels like. So, it's a good question. Thank you for asking. You have to take that one on faith, basically. And then not. Kira.
I hear what you're saying, and I'm thinking about chemistry.
Cool.
Like, sort of like dopamine and, you know, and like some people you meet, you have like a brush, and you kind of feel like you've known them for a long time, and, you know, and then there's like that hook.
Totally. It's a nice hook that can sometimes lead to a really wholesome thing, right?
Sometimes.
As we know.
And there's the part you were talking about, like, well, we're, you know, we're able to choose what's conditioned, right? So, like, maybe those hooks are, like, deeply rooted.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand what you're saying about you know, learning to unhook from that, but when your chemistry is telling you otherwise, how mindful can you be to contradict that?
Lust and aggression and fear and all of the things that hook us are not like cognitive experiences. We don't decide to be like, ah, I will be attracted to that one and that one and that one, and then I will dismiss that and that and that, and that will be a wholesome, functional life, right? We don't do that, right? We are chemistry, if you want to use that vocabulary, right? We can be like, ah, ooh, ah, mmm, and that's just going on. This is partly why this tradition is called a renunciate tradition, that if we want to unhook, and again, not everyone wants to unhook. And it's not even a way, I don't even need to say unhooking is the best. All I can say is the Buddha showed up and said, unhooking is awesome. and I unhooked just a teensy bit, and I was like, ooh, unhooking is awesome. So now I'm a you know, evangelist for unhooking. But other folks were like, hook to these things, it's awesome. Because it was for them, so far. God bless them. And you can go with that path, right? So there's not a judgment built in. There's just the proposition that unhooking leads to certain results that are awesome. And so if you want to unhook, the path toward unhooking requires at a certain point an amount of resistance to our chemistry, right? Because, you know, we're animals that want to reproduce, therefore lust, basically, I think. And then everything else that goes, whether you're lusting in order to reproduce or not, there's a whole system around connection. So the first kind of turning of intention on the path is not to say like, okay, I'm never doing that again, right? You could do that. You could go be a nun. You know, I'll tell you where to go if you want to go. But it's not that. It's actually just, how can I do this in a wholesome way? Like, what will give rise to well-being? And that you can do, right? You could, on a given day, lust after five people, and you could then back up for a moment before you take any of them home and be like, what are the possible futures I could have with these? Whether you're doing near-term or long-term. And you'd be like, this one seems like it'll go in this direction, this one seems like it'll go in this direction. You use your best skills. And then you go in a wholesome direction if you can. You know, hang out with people that are going to be good for you. Good for the both of you. So it's not that you have to try to like unhook from everything all at once, but that the unhooking happens as we start to shape our experience toward what's going to be helpful and healing and safe, etc. So, you know, the first choice is just go home with the right people. And then later on it's, you know, go further than that, right? How can maybe you and the people you go home with practice together? What if that's building Sangha? Choose someone that is going to support your highest self and then go on from there. And yeah, you know, the chemicals keep flowing forever. Anything else? It's our time to fold tonight.
Just for clarification, so yes. At the end of the path is the end of practice, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. But even that is kind of a paradox. The Buddha got all fully enlightened and shit. and then for the next 45 years, not only walked around teaching, but spent the bulk of every day in samadhi. You know, the Buddha would, on a non-teaching day, or many days, would come back, eat his meal, go into his hut, and enter samadhi, and just rest in the states of blissful stillness. In a certain way, it's like, what else are you going to do? Right? You can't be like, going around harassing people about unbinding all day, every day. It's kind of seemed like what the monks did was they practiced all day, and then in the night they would come together and have a talk. So the Buddha himself would do that. He would just chill out. And so we could ask a question, is he still practicing? Or is he just hanging out? Now he's kind of a professional. I'll end with a semi-joke from the Tibetan Buddhist professor and translator Robert Thurman, Uma's dad, professor of Indology at Columbia, who said, Buddhists, they're always talking about practice, practice, practice. What I want to know is, when's the performance? So, with that, thank you for your presence, your kindness. Be free. Just do it. All next month, the month of the four Tuesdays in June, I will talk about nervous system process, fight and flight, animal body, and trauma. Kind of how we get caught in these very particular ways, and how trauma physiology interweaves with our meditation practice. So that's the prequel for June. Or the preview. Thank you for June, the trailer. And yeah, and that's good for now. Onward. So blessings always to each of you. Your donations or offerings of your resources to support this group are both necessary and warmly received. Any amount of offering that you give both supports your own practice of generosity and giving for the sake of the well-being of others and is a little practice in letting go. So thank you for your offerings. They go in the basket there, and I split them 50-50 with the studio. See you next week or anytime. Take good care.